said, rearrange my family tree. A chicken is what I want to be.
Welcome, everyone, to Country Joe's Chicken Show. My name is Karen Watts, also known as Karen at petoftheday.com, and we are here with Country Joe himself.
Hello, hello. I'm here.
That's Joe Barber, chicken farmer extraordinaire. And we have our first guest this time is Craig Russell of the SPPA. That's the Society for Protection of Poultry Antiquities.
Preservation of poultry.
Preservation. Dang. One of these days I'm going to get it right first try. We've had Craig on before, and I always stumble over that. So one of these times I'll get it right. Well, welcome, Craig.
Well, it's good to be here.
Uh-huh.
Nice to be back.
Yes, and now Joe, I'm sure, has a ton of questions for you, but I first had something that I wanted to raise with both of you gentlemen on the air. Now, I'm not a big television viewer. I don't watch Survivor every time, but my husband called me in for one episode in which they were 20-something individuals, you know, full-grown adults. They were given chickens, and they weren't sure how the eggs happened and whether you needed a rooster. And if you had a rooster, how that made, more chickens.
Oh, well, that's basic nature, huh, Craig?
Yes, the rooster fertilizes the egg, but if you're going to have more chickens. But the hens will lay eggs whether or not they have a rooster.
Right, and what one of the guests, one of the contestants said, well, what, after she lays the egg, does the rooster, like, pee on it or something?
That's frightening. But not too different than some other things I've heard. Many fish, not all, but many fish, sort of breed that way. The male deposits the sperm on the eggs after they've been laid. But the more advanced vertebrates, they go for internal fertilization. But years ago, when I was doing zoo work, I was on To Tell the Truth. And one of the fake guests, who was trying to impersonate Clyde Peeling, answered just that way for snake fertilization, and it won over a couple of the panel who were supposed to be experts. We had a good laugh about that.
I guess. Yeah, I've had a lot of people ask me that too. Oh, you need a rooster, and I said, no, you don't need a rooster. As a matter of fact, they're noisy. I hate roosters.
Love roosters, but. And of course, I raise my own chickens, so I need roosters. But I've grown up around them, and I think something's wrong if I don't hear the roosters crowing in the morning.
Uh huh.
But that's not something that's necessarily welcome in a city neighborhood.
No,
right.
Probably not. Although I've been in cities where I heard them, both here, but mostly overseas. I was amazed when I was in the service how common it was to hear roosters crowing in German cities, for instance.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, where else right here in a good-sized city, well, good, nice city, is Key West. We ought to hear that place all day and all night with roosters.
Yes. Yep.
And they have, and you know, there are some cities, I live right outside of the Boston area for people who are listening to the show for the first time, and one of the cities, Newton, where I lived for many years, one was allowed to have up to four hens, but not allowed roosters at all.
Mm-hmm.
And another city where my brother-in-law now lives is Somerville, which is a little bitty wedge of a city, very dense. And when I was driving him to his new apartment for the first time with a load of furniture, I heard a rooster crowing just as he was telling me, and oh, by the way.
You know, Baltimore, which is a very old city, you're allowed to keep chickens in Baltimore, but if you want a rooster, you have to pay a special fee. But the fee was set in the 1700s, so it's only $1.
That's interesting. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, see, most of the cities here in Florida won't allow you to have a rooster at all, and you know, for good reason. But that's the up and coming thing down here is all the chickens and all the little cities down here in Florida now. They're fighting and winning in their town councils to have chickens, and that's been going over real big down here. So, but no roosters.
Yeah.
Well, and of course I know when I was a child, there was certainly a rooster at Aunt Shirley's house up in upstate New York, because those are the scars that are on my right shin when that rooster was getting old and cranky and flew at me, claws straight out, gave me giant puncture wounds. And 2 weeks later, he did that to Aunt Shirley, and she had to get a new rooster, and he was roostering dumplings. So she said he boiled for 2 days.
Yeah. So that's interesting. Yeah, I've got a few roosters here only because, like I say, I breed my own chickens. But other than that, that's it. You know, the hens outnumber them by plenty. You know, I've got my own breeding pens just for that. But
but for anybody who's listening, what Craig Russell said, internal fertilization, that means that the hen and the rooster have to get together just like your mom and your dad did.
That's it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And is there anybody doing, I know for cattle and for show horses, they sometimes do artificial insemination for brood mares and for cows.
Right.
Does anybody do that with the specialized chickens, Craig?
Oh, yes. Artificial insemination is used, for instance, it's used for special matings to make sure everything gets right, but there are some chickens, for instance, many of the show Cornish are so heavy and so short-legged that it takes artificial insemination to make sure they survive. That's done with broad-breasted turkeys. The modern broad-breasted turkey is so heavy that making contact is just about impossible, so the breeding is done with artificial insemination.
Yeah, you know, Craig, I bumped into a guy that used to do that professionally. He used to artificially inseminate 500 turkeys a day. That was his job.
Yes.
That was amazing.
Yep.
And that's not a job you think of when you're when you're a kid growing up. You don't say, you know, when I grow up, I want to be...
No, it's not. But it's much easier with turkeys than with chickens, because the turkeys maintain the semen in their bodies for a lot longer than the chickens do.
Oh.
So one fertilization can last a very long time. With chickens, you probably want to do it to be safe a couple of times a week, certainly every at a minimum of at least once a week, but probably more often than that.
Sure. All the meat chickens are all artificially, aren't they, done the Cornish rocks?
Not necessarily. It depends on the strain and so on. The end product is so heavy that it has a very difficult time breeding naturally, although most of those hens can be inseminated, as can the broad-breasted turkeys, by more normal roosters. But some of the modern strains of what we call Cornish Rock Cross, although many of them are more complex than that, they have other items too, are not F1s, but in some cases F38s or F41s. And the last crosses put together can breed normally. The end result is what Jim Atkins of SPN likes to call a terminal bird, because it can no longer breed naturally.
Right.
And if that's a bird that's going to be on your dinner table, that's perfectly fine with you. You know, gentlemen, we are running out of time for this segment. As you know, Joe still hates it when I say that.
Yeah.
But we'll be right back with more of Country Joe's Chicken Show. And if you want to listen to the show anytime, we are now on iTunes. And you can always go to countryjoeschickenshow.com on the web. And we'll be right back with more, folks.
Rearrange my family tree. A chicken is what I want to be.
Welcome back to Country Joe's Chicken Show. Joe Barber, Country Joe, and I are here talking with Craig Russell from the SPPA, talking all things chicken. Now, Joe, I know that you probably have questions for Craig, because you always do.
Well, what I wanted to tell Craig, because I hadn't talked to him in a while, the last time, which was quite a while ago that I talked to you, Craig, I was telling you I was playing around with that fodder. Remember feeding chickens that fodder, which is a barley where you grow it up out of seed, organic. And since then, I've built a fodder house. My God, my hobby has gone crazy now because I'm over $20,000 into this thing. It's all refrigerated room with 12-foot trays. The water comes on a timer, shuts off, and in 7 days you have fodder. So, So I'm just starting into that now, and I'm really, really interested to see how this experiment's going to go.
I think you'll like it. I never did anything quite that fancy, but I used to feed sprouts every winter, and the birds do well on them.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I heard, and I've been doing a lot of research, and like I said, you know, when I get into this hobby, you know, I mean, here we go. You know, like I said, I have a, down here in Florida, we have a refrigerated room that's temperature controlled because, you know, the fodder has to be 65 to 70 degrees all the time and the humidity and, you know, we're running the whole thing. So right now we're experimenting with that. And I just bought, you're going to love this, a ton of seed, organic seed. It's all organic. So I've got that coming from Minnesota. So That's my new thing, but a lot of people never heard of it or say, oh, gee, I don't know if it's going to work or whatever, but the people that have been talking just say, no problem, 100%, you know, we can go.
It'll do fine, and of course, I'm sure you realize one of the reasons you're doing this is that you increase the free protein available to the birds, plus a lot of other nutrients.
Uh-huh, so it's supposed to be 80% digestibility.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really, I hear nothing but positive things. So
will that cost you a lot in terms of water that you need to sprout the seeds? I know in Florida right now you probably have plenty of water, but it might not be practical in some other parts of the country. How does that work out?
Well, the way that it's set, I have well water anyway, but the way that it's set, it comes on as a mist for 2 minutes every 2 hours, and the water is recycled through into a drum at the end, and it's pumped back through. So it's actually you're saving water, you know. So that's how that works. So I can't wait. You know, we've got the system up and running as a test deal right now. We're waiting for the main thing of seed, but it's supposed to be a lot cheaper. See, what I was trying to do is get away from the GMO corn and the GMO soybeans and all of that and go organic, and which I hopefully succeeded in doing. So and it's supposed to be a lot cheaper and a lot better for you. So that's what we're going to be trying here with about 600 laying chickens.
Excellent. I think you'll have good results. I always found it useful, and it's one of those things that was common practice with old-time poultry people, but with the large modern operations, it generally isn't practical.
Right.
But you have what sounds like a rather mechanized system that should allow you to easily feed 600 birds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm going to do it with my meat turkeys and my meat chickens also. And to get the protein higher, you use other forms of plants that you mix in, such as sunflower, which makes the protein go way up. And
right.
So I'm at about I'm getting it tested, but I'm right now, just for the hens, I'm at about 18-19%.
Oh, that's so excellent.
Yep. So,
and you said that it's got 80% efficiency. So does that mean, thinking of all the small children out there who like to talk about poop, does that mean there'll be less output in that matter?
I don't know. What do you think, Craig? I don't know. I don't know.
I don't think it'll be very noticeable. No. Mm-hmm. You are going to still have some waste. You might reduce it slightly, but you're not gonna notice a huge difference in the waste. Mm-hmm. There's going to be just more efficient use. More of the nutrients are freed up and will be utilized by the bird, but they're still at the end a waste product.
Mm-hmm. So that's my big experimentation. That's what I've been working on here. So I'm really excited about this. If this goes really, really well, then no more grain for me. You know, I grow my own. So it's a lot of fun.
Is this something you can do with any type of chickens, or is it just good for meat chickens? Or
No, it's good for all types of chickens. The grains most commonly used have been barley and oats, but other grains can be used, and blends are often used to do what Joe's talking about, increase the amount of protein or some other nutrient. It's one of those old traditional practices that has fallen by the wayside because of, industrialization, basically. A lot of things that were done traditionally don't work when you have 100,000 laying hens in cages.
Right.
For instance, pumpkin was common livestock feed before the Second World War. Everything from poultry to cows and horses and sheep and goats ate pumpkin.
Ah.
But pumpkins don't lend themselves well to mechanical harvesting and feeding.
Right.
So
they bruise.
What's this? Yes.
They bruise
right.
Easy, but I know the squirrels love them up here. I normally got into the habit of not even thinking of it as a jack-o'-lantern. I was thinking of it as a giant squirrel treat whenever it
right.
came out each year.
Exactly. But
and
a
would that
lot
have
things-
any... So are there things, you know, we've only got 3 minutes left for this segment, but can you, if you have chickens in your backyard, you can feed them, obviously, pumpkin. Can you feed them things like orange peels, banana peels, fruit, things like that?
Well, it's hard for them unless they're ground up to utilize that stuff, although banana peels are loved by a lot of livestock. Interestingly enough, this is away from chickens, but if you feed bananas, whole bananas, to sheep and goats, they eat the peel first and then the fruit. If you feed bananas to pigs, they eat the fruit first and then the peel.
Isn't that something? Wow. Huh. That's interesting. Yeah. Well, I did go get a load of pumpkins after the church couldn't sell them for Halloween, and I did bring them home last year, and the chickens devoured them really quick. So I know they love pumpkins.
Yes, I feed pumpkins every fall. I used to raise my own, and still a few, but and of course gourds and so on. But all the produce stands around the area, when they get past Thanksgiving, most of their pumpkins are up for grabs, and my sheep and my turkeys and my chickens and the peafowl and the ducks and the geese are all eating pumpkins.
Yep. So that's now I get calls from the church bazaars now after Halloween. You know, Joe, you want pumpkins? You know, and all I got to do is just drive up there and there's 100 or 200 pumpkins waiting for me. So.
And, you know, that brings to mind the fact that I know there's at least a couple of chicken farms in the city where I am now. I'm wondering if when their pumpkin fundraiser is over, what they do with them. And if they know that they don't need to discard them, they can bring them over to Owen's Poultry Farm or to the farm at the Gore Estate here in Waltham and make some chickens very happy.
Very much, yes.
Exactly right. Just cut them open and They'll eat everything.
We are running out of time for this segment, and coming up, we're going to have Kermit Blackwood with us. So if folks want to hang on, we'll be right back with more of Country Joe's Chicken Show here on CountryJoesChickenShow.com.
There we go.
Country Joe's Chicken Show. Karen Watts of PetOfTheDay.com here, and Joe Barber, Country Joe himself.
Yeah, we're here with Kermit, and what's new with you?
Oh, not much. Happy to see mud season about here.
Now, whereabouts are you?
Vermont.
In Vermont. I used to live there.
Yeah. Oh, really? Yeah, I live here all the time. Well, I live in Colorado, too, but mostly Vermont.
What part of Vermont? Northern?
I live in Townsend, in Wyndham, northern part of the South.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
And I understand that people in other parts of the country don't understand that New England has five seasons. You all have maybe spring, summer, winter, and fall. We have winter, mud season, spring, summer. Sometimes.
Yeah. Gotta love it.
Now, I know you wanted to come on and talk to us about peafowl.
Yes, I get so many emails and questions on forums and things about peafowl, and I always wanted an opportunity to just let people know what I know about peafowl, and so that maybe there'd be a little bit more understanding about them.
Okay, that sounds good.
And for people who are thinking, what's peafowl? You all know what peacocks are.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the boys.
Yep.
And the hens are the peafowl.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we have the peahen and the peacock. And then actually, it's interesting. Before DNA, you know, every animal encyclopedia or dictionary that you will look up the word peacock in, it will say that peacocks are a member of the pheasant family. Mm-hmm. And it'll go on from there. And that the male shows off his pretty feathers to attract the mate.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been about 20 years going and then some, where DNA has been shown, and it continues to be with, you know, papers all the time, that peafowl are not pheasants. They belong to their own little family. They're not closely related to pheasants. And they are their own very unique little family of birds. And there are two birds that are called pheasants, the crested argus and the great argus, which are peafowl. There's also the Congo peafowl. There's our familiar Indian blue peafowl, and then there are about four or five different species of green peafowl that we used to think were just subspecies of each other. But once we started really looking at them on a molecular level, we realized that they're really not as closely related as they look.
You know, it never made sense to me as a child that pheasants and peacocks would be related, because pheasants never do that with their tail. They just don't.
That's true.
You know, an interesting distinction is that in the wild, peafowl perch on emergent trees, which are trees that are above the canopy. So if the jungle is 300 feet tall or 120 feet tall, there's always a couple of trees that are even taller. They're the oldest trees in the forest. And that's where peafowl, argus, Congo peafowl, and regular peafowl perch at night. And through the rainy season, too. And in situations where the tropical forest has been replaced with the tropical grassland, those giant trees tend to survive. And that's why when the jungle comes back, there's still an emergent tree there.
Mm-hmm.
And the typical peafowl that we think of, the peacock with the big tail, they continue to perch in those giant emergent trees. And pheasants, they don't. Pheasants are really worried about coming out from cover, really. They don't go very far out into the open. But typical peafowl don't seem to have any real reservations about going well out into the open, into fields and what have you, and they're just not as worried about birds of prey as pheasants. And they also, you know, they take several years to grow up to be completely adult, and their eggs take a long time to incubate, and the parents are very involved with the chicks and for an extended period of time, whereas pheasants, you know, there's a little bit, they breed faster, they breed younger, and the parents aren't as involved with the chicks for as long. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the distinctions.
And I found something really interesting about that. We have a neighbor that's about, 5 miles away from here. And a while back, she bought a bunch of peafowl, and they were everywhere but her house. And that's where they continue to stay. It was everywhere
right.
but her house. So I you know, that's why I never got any. But there's got to be 40, 50 of those things that live in the woods around here. You can hear them see them every now and then. But she can never keep them at her place. And that's that was always an interesting thing. I don't know if that's normally what they do or what is it. They just never.
You know, they're a lot like a cat. You know,
uh-huh.
They will find the place that they want to be, and that is where they will be. And I grew up on an old ranch out in the Sierra Mountains on the Nevada-California border, pretty far up in the north. Old historic horse ranch. It's been there since the 1800s, and there had been peacocks on that ranch. You know, some of them probably came over, you know, well, no, of course they came over before there were cars. And
right.
then over the years, they would bring a few more. But the mm-hmm. flock of peacocks that was around when I was a little boy had been on the ranch since the 50s. So, because a bunch of them had been, you know, they just died out, I think. And they still had a couple birds. So anyway, I remember one year when I was about 6 or 8, and one of the peacocks just showed up on our end of the ranch, and they had been living about 8 miles away, still on the same ranch, but, you know, mm-hmm. at a different corner of the ranch. And so they just showed, this one bird just showed up one day, and his name was Timothy, and he was my pet, and I thought he was a dragon, because I really didn't have a concept of what a peacock was. You know,
uh-huh.
he was just as tall as me, or just about, so I thought I had a dragon.
Wow.
But,
do people raise peacocks like they do for with turkeys and chickens? Do they raise them for eating, or are they all just decorative? Or what if someone wants to try to raise peacocks anyway, if they don't move
originally
away?
Originally, people raised peafowl to protect their chickens from birds of prey and from
mm-hmm.
foxes and skunks and things like that. They really do have a use.
Mm-hmm.
If you have peafowl, the birds of prey will just not come around as much, because the peafowl, not being afraid of them, perch up high frequently, and they have very good eyes, and they tell the hawk that they can see it and that they will hurt it if it were to come into their environment. But more importantly, they keep, you know, the birds of prey or any predator prefers unsuspecting prey. So because
right.
the peafowl sees it, you know, it just gives up. But yes, today people raise them and they've become very domesticated. There are all kinds of strains of peacocks that are different color varieties and things. And I have never been able to keep up with it, but it's absolutely brilliant what people do with them.
Mm-hmm.
But those are very, very domestic. And I think that their only purpose is as, you know, pets or like goldfish or something, you know, they're just something to look at.
I know they're very loud. I know that. Really loud.
Well, the one species is very loud, but only the one. None of the
mm-hmm.
other peafowl are as loud. Well, Arguses can be loud, but, and actually, too, peafowl are noisy for a couple of months out of the year, and the rest of the year you won't hear them at all, unless something got after them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I remember one of the families in my hometown, which is just a small town in the middle of Massachusetts, their mother of the family, her son was my brother's age, decided she wanted to raise peafowl, and as soon as the males got to a certain age, the police station started getting calls that I think there's a woman being murdered in the woods up by the Stewart's house.
Oh, God.
That is unfortunate. Yeah, the Indian peafowl has a terrible shriek for those couple of months a year. But the green peafowl really don't. I mean, they have sort of a sound that sounds a bit like an owl and a cat together, but not terrible. And the Arguses, they make a wonderful bell sound. I can't quite explain it, but it's hilarious. But yeah, they can be pretty noisy. But you know, something that's interesting in my academic work that I've been discovering about peafowl is that the whole idea that the peacock is spreading his tail to attract a mate is actually not quite correct.
Wow.
Yeah, what we've discovered is that peafowl actually pair up when they are about 2 years old, generally a little bit earlier than that even. So even though they're still in their parents' care, they hang out with each other, and they pair up really early. And then, so when you see the male showing off, he's not really attracting a mate. What he's doing is he's demonstrating to the female how he will protect her nest and her chicks from things like pythons.
Wow.
And other large reptiles.
Kermit, I'm going to stop you right there. We are running out of time for this segment, and I'm sure there's more to that than 20 seconds will allow. Folks, we'll be right back with more of Country Joe's Chicken Show.
Rearrange my family tree. A chicken is what I want to be.
Welcome back to Country Joe's Chicken Show. We have as our guest Kermit Blackwood here with Joe himself and I. And we're talking about peacocks. Now, we're talking about those spectacular tails. I mean, they're so well known for their tails that, you know, NBC has their peacock as their logo.
Right. Boy, there's so much about peacocks I didn't know, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
So this idea of proud as a peacock is kind of silly, but very quickly, reptiles, where they live in the subtropics of Asia, there are pythons, there are king cobras, there are monitor lizards that can be the size of a dog. And these animals are just, these reptiles are constantly hungry, and they're growing as long as they live, and they eat eggs, and they eat chicks, and they eat a peahen. But they don't touch the adult males, and they don't do that because, A, they can't digest feathers. B, the way that the snakes swallow and the monitor lizards swallow, you know, they can't use their hands. The snake obviously can't, but neither can the lizard, to remove feathers. So they swallow the whole thing. They digest this large meal. But then they have to, then they've got to regurgitate those feathers. And so the peacock's feathers are very specially designed to swell up in the digestive acids, and then the hurls gag the reptile.
Uh-huh.
So what they do is they communicate to the reptile that you can't eat me, and more importantly, I will hurt you. I will spur you.
You try to eat me, you're going to regret it.
Oh,
exactly.
That's interesting.
So the peacock vibrates because the reptiles can't hear or see the way that we can or the birds can. So they communicate to the reptile how large they are and what their temperament is.
Uh-huh.
That's really neat. Now,
yeah,
because peacocks grew up in that sort of area, what do they eat?
That's an interesting question. You know, all those feathers require a lot of energy.
Yeah.
And it takes 3 years for the babies to actually become mature. And one of the reasons is because they are predators. They're obligatory predators. They are omnivores. They eat fruit. They eat lots of leaves. They eat lots of seeds and things. But their most important food are frogs. They're actually a frog specialist. And they love locusts and grasshoppers and any kinds of insects. But really, they wade along the streams and out in the grass. And they are reptile. They eat baby snakes. They eat hatchling lizards. And frogs. They actually specialize in frogs. So when you're raising them in captivity, something that's really important for people to remember is right before they start to molt, like when you find a feather or two, it is time to change the diet and increase the amount of fat and animal protein. So if you can do that, you can do that really simply by, I would just suggest using prawns in the shell. So you, gosh darn it, I'm sorry. you feed the, I turned it off and it's still on. But anyway, you,
prawns,
you know,
in the shell, fish,
the prawns in the shell. So you boil the prawns in the shell, you cut them up into fairly, you know, you don't have to really worry about it because a peacock can swallow a frog. So, you know, or a mouse. so it doesn't need to be that small, but in the shell. And then the Brazil nut. Anytime you can, throw your pea bell a Brazil nut, any time of the year. But when it's molting, it's growing feathers that have pushed those other feathers out. So if you want them to be really, really colorful and really have healthy feathers, give them lots of nuts and prawns. And of course, keep them off the soy in the pellets. If you can find a food that doesn't have soy in it, by all means use that. Adding turkey food, because it's higher in protein, is only providing more crude protein. And because it's all locked up in soy, that's really a protected protein. So it's not the best thing for peafowl. The domestic ones can handle it, but if you're raising green peafowl or you're trying to have a white peacock be iridescent, which they can be if you feed them properly, then you have to feed them properly.
Now, how often do they molt those feathers? Because as a child, I was always fascinated by peacock feathers, but I didn't want them if I knew that, you know, you had to kill the peacock to get the feathers.
Oh, no. They molt them every year. They lose them all. The trains all fall out in the late summer. Well, the green peafowl seem to do it quite a bit earlier.
And you mentioned, I didn't know that there were different varieties of, or different breeds of peacock. I thought a peacock was a peacock was a peacock.
Well, there are all these interesting people. And, you know, if you look at the Japanese maples and the flowering cherries and the goldfish and the fighting fish, there's all these, you know, thousands of years of human beings doing wonderful things with selective breeding. And there are some guys out there and ladies who have taken, and I would call them cultivars. They're not breeds. But they breed true, and they breed them, and they breed them, and they just keep selecting for a specific mutation. And, like, guineas come in different colors, and turkeys come in different colors. I think the turkeys are more of a breed at this point, but the peafowl aren't as domesticated, but there are different cultivars, and they're really quite interesting. I've tried to keep them on my farms and things, and I've found that they don't do well loose. So, you know, I don't keep them. But my favorite one, which actually did do well for a while, was a opal Spalding. I think it was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life. His name was Stanley. He did really well. And then one day he got a guinea hen angry, a male guinea hen. And the guinea hen just kept chasing him up the road. And whereas the other peacocks would just figure it out, he just disappeared one day. And that was after 4 years of doing really well with us. So... that certainly didn't happen to any of my other peafowl. So I think that the domesticated birds, they're not as camouflaged. You have to remember that predators don't see in color.
Right.
So when they're iridescent, they're actually very hard to see when they're standing in the trees, because where the shadow touches it, it burns in, and where the light touches it, it reflects. So the bird can be quite active, and as the branches are swinging and what have you, it's a perfect projection screen on their bodies. But as soon as you get one of these birds that has... No iridescence or reduced iridescence in the purples and things, you'll find that the predators seem to pick them off quite a bit faster. But if you live up in New England, the black-shouldered mutation does really well because it looks like birch bark, the females. And the males are fine, too. But that's more of like a mutation. It isn't really any different than the typical Indian, unless it's super, super inbred.
Now, what about the pure white ones? I've seen where they sell the pure white peacocks. Those are beautiful.
Yeah. Well, they're really wonderful, unless somebody's been breeding them to the point that they're just really useless. But they're, originally there was a wild white-green peafowl from the coast of Cochin in the China Sea there, between Vietnam and China. And so there were wild white-green peafowl. And the emperors and the Japanese... you know, exported them to extinction eventually, and those things ended up breeding regular Indian peafowl, and then people started breeding for white peafowl, and eventually they had pure white peafowl. And so then, you know, now there's just like really well-established white peafowl lines. But other people get those birds and they breed them like chickens, and they don't feed them right, so the birds are, you know, not hatched out of the right egg to begin with, and they're really, really fragile, and they die easily. But there are some wonderful birds out there. I just love white peacocks. And, you know, they're not iridescent normally, but if you feed them properly, you can make them iridescent, especially if you have a female white peacock that's laying eggs and you feed it correctly. The eggs that hatch will have the genes turned on, and the feathers that lock together are what makes it structural iridescence.
Now, what should they eat? What should they eat to make it that way?
The prawns and the shell really helps.
Yep.
And a really good food. I mean, I always suggest ultra kibble, but you could use whitefish and sweet potato dog food. And just make sure that you've got as much keratin as possible. Chitin. So crustacean shell is basically what does it. And then enough of a healthy fat, a digestive fat.
Okay, we are running out of time for this segment. We'll have one more. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more with Kermit. And we are Country Joe's Chicken Show here, now available on iTunes as a podcast. And, of course, always on CountryJoesChickenShow.com. Folks, we'll be right back with more. Country Joe's Chicken Show. And today, you know, we really do talk about all kinds of poultry on the show. And so today we are still talking about peacocks and peafowl with Kermit Blackwood. Now, getting back to what you said of them not being related to pheasants and them being like they will eat frogs and they will eat snakes. I know, Joe, where you are in Florida, you have a lot of snakes, right?
Yeah, and I was just thinking of that as he was talking about that, about how they're eating cottonmouths and rattlers. And boy, you know, I mean, I haven't seen any, thank God, for about 6 months out here, but they're out here. And you know, now I'm thinking, boy, now I got those peacocks around.
Eat the babies. You know, they chase the adult snakes, but they really eat the babies. And if you think about 30 eggs being hatched, you know, that's a big... It's a lot of babies, and they, you know, they get eaten by a lot of things, but a lot of things are could be envenomated. They could be poisoned, and the peafowl are immune, so they don't care.
I was going to ask you about
And peafowl are related to pheasants, but they're, you know, like dogs and cats are related, too. They're both carnivores, but they are not each other's closest relatives.
So they're both
peafowl
birds.
And pheasants are related, But peafowl are more related to guinea fowl and to chuckers than they are to pheasants.
And you know, one of the things that I was surprised about years ago, I was on the big island of Hawaii. We were out in the middle of nowhere. We drove to the end of the island, the southernmost tip. And when we were going through, it's basically a wild area there. And at one point we went past, I don't know, it was sugarcane and other stuff that was growing up wide. And there was what looked like a 4 foot tall blue bird. And when we finally got to where there were people again, we stopped for gas and said, "What the?" And she said, "Oh yeah, that was just somebody's peacock that got loose, and they're now living on the island out in the free."
Right. I think there have been peacocks on Hawaii since, you know, I think they were released there probably the first boat that came out there. You know, peacocks seem to be like one of the first things that people carry. You know, they're a funny bird.
Now, do
people don't.
Go ahead.
I think people don't quite imagine how well they fly either. I mean, the domestic ones don't fly as well, but in the wild, peafowl fly really well. Like 12 or 20 miles wouldn't be that unusual. You know, I mean, if something got after them or there was a fire or a volcano. So they certainly do move.
Yeah, these around here fly pretty good. And I mean, they get way up into these high trees. I'm surprised.
Right.
I love watching them right around, you know, dark. You know, when it starts to get dark, up they go. And they're like wild. You know, I mean, you know, they won't come to you or anything.
Yeah, they don't really need much, and they just like to bother you and poop in your yard mostly. But they certainly are a wonderful creature. You know, once you've had peafowl and been around them, it's just such a miracle. And to look at them and just see nature's design. And, you know, it's just one of those creatures where you can't possibly be such a scientist that you can't see something really incredible and beyond beyond this world, you know.
Yeah.
It's just one of those
wonderful
creatures.
That's right. And, you know, we even had once a peacock be nominated and featured as Pet of the Day, and it was one of the white peacocks, and it was this person's just best friend.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah. And
there's a group, the United Peafowl Association, that's been around a while, and I heard that they are going, you know, like they kind of like, you know, petered out like some of these clubs do, and the generations mm-hmm. of people aren't just quite as active sometimes. Mm-hmm. But I hope that people that are interested in peafowl will look up that organization and join and contribute, you know, really participate, because there's all these peafowl in captivity, and nobody really, you know, they talk about them, but it just doesn't seem like they're necessarily, their care is becoming as common knowledge as it should be. I mean, everywhere you read, they'll say, feed it like a turkey, and mm-hmm. then in the same forum, they'll be talking about, oh, my peacock has a respiratory infection, and oh, my peacock has something in its eye. It's like,
yep.
Well, they get sick because their immune functions are challenged. And because they are not in great shape, they tend to get sick. Also, if you lock them up in a real dusty environment, it's just not good, because they're designed to be perched as high as possible, so their nostrils allow them to breathe in a lot more of the filthy chicken dust, mm-hmm. which is called smut.
Mm-hmm. Now, how much room would you need if you wanted to keep pheasant, not pheasant, peacocks?
You know, I have seen peafowl kept in, you know, Thailand and Indonesia, in Mexico, and really small enclosures that I wouldn't suggest people keep them in. But, you know, they don't need an incredible amount of space. I think that an ideal peafowl aviary would be 20-foot square. You know what I mean? You could go that small.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about the height. If you can go tall, you can do much smaller. So as long as it's at least 20 foot square, you're okay. And then if you can make it 20 foot tall, you have a lot more room. And another thing that people tend to do with pheasants and peafowl is they make the mistake of making this nice enclosure, but then they waste a lot of space by wasting the walls. That's a physically accessible space. There's also the center of the enclosure where you could take a bunch of those big spools that they put cable on, and you can
right.
stack those one on top of the other. But there's so much space that the birds don't end up using. So you could have more room if you are more creative by making more of your aviary or chicken coop for your chickens physically accessible to them. So shelves and lofts and things to climb and sun on.
And the other thing I noticed, too, is these birds are fairly expensive for, you know, I'm looking at in some of these catalogs, they're like $50 a piece.
I have some peafowl that cost me $2,700 for a pair.
Isn't that amazing? I never knew that. Yeah, what kind would those be?
those were some green peafowl. And then a crested argus, I mean, that'll set you back $6,000 or $10,000 a pair.
Really?
A great argus would probably be $2,500 a pair.
Oh, my
and
God.
And some of these green peafowl that have just come over from Germany, I would imagine would, you know, put you back a little bit, too. And I know people would say, oh, that's ridiculous, but I'm actually all for it because it keeps the idiots from taking something that they don't have any business having. You know?
Well, that's what I mean about, you know, when you buy them and they get loose, or they let them loose, and they don't live at your house anymore, and you paid hundreds and thousands of dollars for some of these things,
right?
You know? And,
well,
and they're
I'll
living
you what, you know, and
your neighbor paid money to get her peacocks that are now, you know, eating the snakes on your property.
I know.
Right.
That's what's so funny. You know, I'm laughing about that now when I'm looking at the price of these things.
Well, you know, some of them are going to be expensive. Some of them, the people will give them away. You know, it's like anything else, like dogs or horses or what have you. But, you know, I have some family in Egypt, and many years ago, I was out in the tribal lands, which is in the western desert, and there's a big Christian monastery, and where I had an uncle who was a monk. And like several generations of us had been monks there or priests there. And there was all these problems with snakes, cobras and asps and things. And I was there for like 2 months and I was so bored. So I decided to get a bunch of green peafowl. So I spent this incredible amount of money getting a bunch of green peafowl. I was probably 18 at the time. And now there's a flock of green peafowl out there. And the snakes and the scorpions have just about, they're still around. But, you know, you can tread into the gardens and not worry about getting stung. And they were worth it. You know, the price was worth it because the mortality of the birds was really, really low. And they look after themselves and they don't need people. But, you know, those are not objectives that people that want to have a pet peacock have. But, you know, it just depends on what kind of are you a collector? You know, do you build an aviary that's like for a masterpiece, or are you a hobbyist who just enjoys things to hang out with? And if you are, then you don't need to spend a bunch of money to get a peacock. But, you know, I think it just depends on the strain of the birds, and they're really well bred. If the breeder is really interesting, like some of these really interesting characters out there, like, I don't know him, but Brad Legg. He does all kinds of really interesting things. And, oh, my gosh, Clifton Nicholson. He's like this American treasure. He's one of the greatest artists of our time. He created the purple peacock. And he just does all these fascinating things. I would spend lots of money to buy a Clifton Nicholson bird.
Well, you know, we are out of time for this show, folks. But
yeah. Bummer.
If you, I know, between Kermit and Joe, I'm the meanie. I make you stop talking.
But we're going to have you back, Kermit. Don't worry. We'll have you back on.
Well, excellent. Awesome. You know, folks, you can always ask any questions of us you want. If you go to countryjoeschickenshow.com, that's where you can find the show. And you can contact me if you have a pet peacock you want to nominate at Karen@petoftheday.com. And folks, we'll be back with more Country Joe's Chicken Show.
I'm a green chicken.